It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Green Bay's mayor says the head of a Republican-backed investigation into the 2020 election made false statements. We'll get the details and hear what the Republican leadership in the state Senate has to say about the ongoing investigation. First, earlier today, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke to mark the first anniversary of the insurrection that took place at the U.S. Capitol. Here's a little of Vice President Harris's remarks delivered from Statuary Hall outside the House chamber.
What the extremists who roamed these halls targeted was not only the lives of elected leaders. What they sought to degrade and destroy was not only a building, hallowed as it is. What they were assaulting were the institutions, the values, the ideals that generations of Americans have marched, picketed, and shed blood to establish and defend.
Our next guest says the events of January 6th of last year are just one result of a buildup of unchecked intolerance and hate in the United States. He's worried that hate is on the rise and could have more and increasingly bad consequences. But there's good news. He says that everyday people can do a lot to help turn the tide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about, do you see a rising tide of hatred and intolerance in the country? Do you see this as a big problem? And what do you want to see done about it? Do you take action in your local community? What do you want to see from the government, social media platforms, and others? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jonathan Greenblatt, a CEO of the Anti-Defamation League and author of the new book just out this week called It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You mentioned January 6th of last year multiple times in your book. Can you share your thoughts on this anniversary, especially as it relates to hate and intolerance, the subject of your book?
Well, I think January 6th is an incredibly solemn anniversary, and one that I think all Americans, regardless of how you vote or where you sit on a political spectrum, need to take very seriously. This was what I would describe as not just a terror attack, but the most predictable terror attack in American history, because the perpetrators literally said in advance that their goal was to subvert the democratic process, to interrupt the election certification. And their use of weapons and their the employment of violent rhetoric and their effort to try to capture and kidnap and potentially kill legislators is something that we need to take very, very seriously. But unfortunately, I would say this was really the culmination of 5 years of increasing, amplifying, intensifying polarization and the normalization of extremism in this country. And so while I think many were stunned by what happened that day, we were certainly at ADL shocked, but not at all surprised, because we tracked the extremists and we knew, again, this is what they were planning. This is what they were saying they would do. And we watched it come to pass.
You mentioned the normalization of hatred, ideas that might have seemed fringe and been only seen on the margins, becoming more and more in some ways mainstream. How did that happen?
Well, I think there are multiple factors that contribute to the moment we're in today, the rise of extremism and illiberalism. Number one, I think we have political figures who have employed extremism as a, not just a tactic to use on occasion, but a strategy to try to inflame their base and divide the nation. Starts with President Trump. And I don't really care how you vote. I care in terms of what you value. And the president's repeated use of racist rhetoric, of divisive language, employing various stereotypes, and literally giving license to some of the worst elements of society. I mean, when given the chance after Charlottesville, he talked about very fine people. When given the chance in a presidential debate to condemn the Proud Boys, he asked them to stand back and stand by. And then, of course, on the heels of the insurrection, as has been, you know, documented now by the January 6th joint committee, he literally told the rioters, after hours and hours of waiting, that he quote unquote loved them. I mean, there is simply no precedent, but the president and other elected officials' willingness to engage in extremists is one reason why we have this problem. I think secondly, we have a much higher degree of polarization today. Communities are divided, you know, lingering socioeconomic inequities, the persistence of, you know, extremists now in the political conversation has divided not just, you know, our cities and towns, but families and circles of friends. Over and over, I hear these stories all over the U.S. And then finally, I think social media has a lot to do with why we are where we are today. I mean, whereas once, like, you know, Wisconsin Public Radio, we had a news media that were more responsible with editorial processes and standards and practices and ombudsman. Today, Facebook is kind of feeding intravenously fictions and lies, you know, into the bloodstream. And the idea that millennials and Gen Z are getting their news not from, you know, NPR, if you will, but from TikTok should deeply terrify all of us.
Talking to Jonathan Greenblatt about his new book, It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, we'll talk more about possible solutions in a bit. I want to hear your definition of the it, and it could happen here. What is the unthinkable? What do you worry if we don't take the right kind of actions? What do you worry that this leads to?
Well, look, I'm speaking to you today, you know, nestled here in New York City, but the reality is I'm the grandson of a Holocaust survivor from Germany. You know, from a Jewish family who my grandfather, when he was a young man, could never have imagined that the only country he ever would have known, he ever knew, would one day turn on him, regard him as an enemy of the state, destroy everything that he loved, and slaughter almost his entire family and friends. And I speak to you today as the husband of a political refugee from Iran, whose family had lived there for, they would say, thousands of years. And it was the only country they had ever known. And they never would have imagined that after the Islamic Revolution, that the government would regard them as enemies of the state, that it would destroy everything that they loved and force them to flee for their lives. So whether it was in Iran, in the Middle East, in the 1980s, or it was in Nazi Germany, in Europe in the 1930s. As a Jewish person, as a human being, we've seen stable societies shift almost overnight and come apart at the seams, and demagogues divide communities to marginalize individuals, and we watch communities erupt into civil war. And so what could happen here? From the demonization of immigrants to the attacks on Asian Americans, to the, again, rise of anti-Semitism that we've seen in recent years, I think we are more vulnerable than we might realize. And I believe all of this, too, could unravel if we don't take steps to stop it. And that's really why I wrote the book.
Let's start talking about some of those steps now. And some of it can start on a very personal level. You talk about how we can confront and counsel people for using, for expressing bias, for expressing hatred, maybe even out of ignorance. What can we do in our day-to-day lives if it's that that relative or that coworker we're talking to?
Well, that's a really good question and an important point. I mean, I think all of us have the power to stop hate. There's no silver bullet, right? There's no magic wand that we can wave that will end intolerance. I mean, I guess that's quite obvious. But the ADL is the oldest anti-hate organization in the United States. We've been doing this work for well over 100 years. And I say that because I wrote the book to share strategies and tactics and tips that we found that work. And it is indeed a whole of society approach that we need, right? It's an all hands on deck moment that requires, you know, schools and businesses and faith communities and government and individuals. So what can we do? Well, as individuals, when we see hate happen, number one, we've got to call it out. Like literally, whether it's at the water cooler or in the locker room or at the kitchen table, I think all of us need to interrupt intolerance when it happens. That's important to enforce norms like, you know, compassion and kindness. I think number two, I really believe we've got to cancel culture altogether. We've got to lose the litmus tests.
this idea today where we excommunicate people because of the idea that they make a single mistake. I mean, my Jewish faith teaches me that everyone has the power of redemption and can amend for their errors. And I think we need to embrace that ethos. And then number three, I think we deeply need to reinvest in civil society. Literally, whether it's volunteering or voting or participating in a political process to push back on the people who would suppress the right to vote, you know, the people who would try to come to a school board meeting and bully people into about conspiracies on masks or whatever kind of craziness. All of us need to realize that democracy is not a spectator sport that you can watch from the cheap seats and everything will work out. No. We have to be on the field. We all have to play the game if we want this to go in the right direction.
We're talking to Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, looking at his new book out this week. It's called It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see, as our guest does, this rising tide of public intolerance and hate? What solutions would you suggest? What questions do you have for our guest? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our conversation now with Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, author of the new book, It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Remember that when all this stuff takes place, the economics of whatever country is in is pretty much destroyed because Americans are, I mean, human beings are nice when things are going well. When things aren't going well, human beings, things go south really quick. But as far as the situation in Washington, what Thomas Jefferson says, you have to have an informed populace, otherwise you don't have a democracy. All the mainstream media outlets across the board in this country have not done their job. Otherwise, you wouldn't even have people like that thinking that way. That means that your democracy is pretty much broken just because of what Thomas Jefferson says.
Dan, thanks for the call. Jonathan, mainstream media fell down on the job here, Dan says.
Well, it's certainly true that I think we can criticize mainstream media because there are always biases, there are always holes in coverage, there are always stories that get missed. But I'm of the opinion that the mainstream media generally does a pretty good job. Sure, you can watch some of the cable news stations and gets trapped in a filter bubble that only look at things from the left or the right. But the reality is, on a day-to-day basis, I think a lot of the mainstream media, from New York Times to the Washington Post to the Journal, do, I think, a pretty good job of calling out, have done a pretty good job of keeping government and keeping business honest. Now, that being said, I think the evaporation of local news media has been a big problem. And I think, again, Facebook and Craigslist and the internet has gobbled that up without any recourse. And of course, there are loopholes that allow them to evade the same kind of responsibility that local news has always had. More local news would help to, I think, bind our communities better together at the local level.
Dan, thanks for the call. We'll go to Dwayne next in Wausau. Dwayne, hi.
Oh, hi. So I saw on the news today that one of the mothers of one of the guys going to be getting sentenced for the insurrection said it all started when he started absorbing, like, Rush Limbaugh, Alex Jones, that guy from InfoWars, who was the one that said, was it Parkland, that was a false flag where these were actors, none of the kids got killed. I mean, and it's scary that these people will believe that, you know, or Americans will believe that they just didn't have the common sense and knowledge to know that, you know, there were lives taken that day and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't actors and it wasn't set up so that affect gun control and people going down these rabbit hole websites, like some guy on his computer can say to his wife, oh, honey, look, I just found something that the top epidemiologists and the, you know, all the scientists have missed.
I gotcha, Dwayne. Thanks for the call. Jonathan, Dwayne pointing at, conservative media, but also particularly conspiracy theory media and internet.
Dwayne is entirely correct. And so, again, I think there are extremes on both sides, but Fox News and you know, Newsmax and AON putting out this madness that what happened a year ago today wasn't a terror attack or an insurrection, and the willingness of mainstream media to take people like Alex Jones, who is not, he's not even a, to call him a journalist isn't not only wrong, he's not even an effective performer. I mean, he is an like a bad actor, knowingly promoting lies. Again, and this, the caller was referring to Sandy Hook and his propounding, creating the conspiracy that Sandy Hook didn't happen. I mean, I think the fact that Facebook and Twitter and these other services have moved these people from the margins into the mainstream, that their algorithms are engineered to inflame and amplify the worst kind of content because it drives clicks, is beyond reproach. And I really do believe, much like big tobacco, much like big oil, these companies need to be addressed from a regulatory perspective, broken up, and held responsible for the damage they're doing to society.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jonathan Greenblatt is with us talking about his new book, It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, a lot of concern on the January 6th anniversary with hatred on the right. You make a point in the book of calling out where you see things like especially anti-Semitism appearing on the left, mm-hmm. and hoping mm-hmm. people on the left can police their own. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, there's no doubt, like, the extreme right has a tendency, a propensity to be violent. If you look at the extremist-related murders over the last decade, the overwhelming majority, 75 to 80%, were committed by people we would characterize as right-wing extremists, be they white supremacists, sovereign citizens, anti-government activists, armed militia members. Nonetheless, there is also intensifying intemperance among the far left. And I think it manifests in many different ways, but the sort of illiberalism and the kind of thought policing that occurs and the norms that are brought about and enforced can explode as well. And we saw this last May after the fighting in Gaza, where you had Jews being beaten up in broad daylight simply for the crime of wearing a kippah or being visibly identifiable as Jewish. Now, make no mistake, you can have strong feelings about what Israel's policies are, I know that I do, or in events in the Middle East, but beating up Jewish people is not a rational response, just like you could have strong feelings about what the government in Beijing is doing to the Uyghur population in China or to the Tibetan population or clamping down on a democracy in Hong Kong or so on and so forth. But that's not an excuse to beat up elderly Asian people. And yet the people committing those crimes weren't wearing MAGA hats. They weren't white supremacists. They were overwhelmingly coming from anti-Israel events. And they characterized themselves more often than not as progressive. And yet we didn't have major progressive leaders speaking out. We didn't have major figures from the liberal media giving it the kind of attention the issue deserved. And the reality is that when they did, it was often equivocating, often trying to do so, but only when they would at the same time decry the violence in the Middle East. Now, again, I think we need to stop hate when it happens, not to qualify our concerns. We need to recognize the common humanity in all people. And just ultimately, you know, neither side of the political spectrum is exempt from intolerance. And the belief that one side is or isn't more, no side has a monopoly on morality. And I think we've got to be willing to meet each other in the middle. That's the only way we'll get through this moment.
Go back to our callers now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. And hi, what Jonathan was just saying actually kind of dovetails into what I was calling to say, which is just that I feel that so many of the problems, so much of the hatred and intolerance, and even, you know, things like believing in conspiracies or that Sandy Hook was a false flag, other things like that, comes down to a lack of empathy for others and otherization of different groups of people. You know, the people who, for example, believe Sandy Hook was a false flag, you know, they don't have that or sent threats to the parents of children who died, aren't empathizing, aren't seeing those people as, you know, fellow human beings. People didn't, you know, people who don't.
I got you. Michael, we just have a couple minutes left. And Jonathan, how can we start to rebuild that empathy that Michael is hoping to see?
Empathy and kindness indeed are what we need. Now, I think we also need some other things too. I think we need accountability. So if you commit a crime, whether you're looting a store or you are rampaging through the Capitol, people need to be held accountable for their actions, again, regardless of the politics of the day. Number two, we need to meet our fellow man in the middle and recognize that while there may be things we disagree with in terms of the issues, our common humanity is far deeper and stronger. I really believe that. And I think number three, there are some things we're going to need help on, like the government getting these social media companies to finally behave with the same level of responsibility that you do on this radio station. So closing the loopholes and pushing them to put people over profits is long overdue.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last few moments, Jonathan, you've been looking head on at a lot of disturbing hate here. Coming out of it, though, do you still feel a sense of optimism?
Oh, I feel deep optimism. Look, an earlier caller was saying, you know, when times get tough, you know, people are on edge. That's true. But this country has endured world wars. It has endured economic depression. It has endured civil strife and civil war. And yet we have always come through it, survived and thrived. This is the greatest democracy in the history of the world. I believe in American exceptionalism. I believe we are continuing on the quest for a more perfect union. So while we are not, you know, at the promised land, I do believe, to invoke Dr. King, that we will get there. And I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that we'll weather this moment and again, come out stronger and sturdier on the other side.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. We talked to him about his new book. It's out this week, called It Could Happen Here: Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Coming up after the news, a GOP-backed investigation into the 2020 election is expanding. We'll hear what they're looking for from WPR's State Capitol reporter. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talked to a lawyer about her work to keep the federal government from foreclosing on family farms during the 1980s farm crisis and the lessons that case has for farmers today. First, the Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election in Wisconsin continues. Now, one of the local officials being deposed is making accusations against the person running the investigation. Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich is accusing former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman of making false statements, and Genrich's legal team is asking for a court to penalize Gableman for it. We're getting the latest on the lawsuits, counter-lawsuits, and the investigation itself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of this investigation expanding its scope? Do you want to see it continue, or do you think it's gone on long enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter and co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
A lot going on related to this investigation. Let's start with the most recent story, the one I just mentioned. The mayor of Green Bay, his lawyer accusing Gableman of false statements. What's going on?
So basically what's going on there is a disagreement over Genrich's level of cooperation with the election investigation. So Gableman subpoenaed actually the mayors of the state's five largest cities in October to provide information to investigators about how election administration went in their communities in 2020. Genrich was one of those mayors, of course, and there has been kind of confusion and back and forth since then about the power of the subpoenas. There have been lawsuits about the subpoenas, whether they're enforceable, the scope of the subpoenas, what needs to be provided in terms of documentation and in-person testimony. And what Gableman has said, both in legal filings and in some public comments, is that Genrich has refused basically to cooperate and provide in-person testimony. And Genrich's lawyers have pushed back now in this official capacity and said that's not true, that Gableman and Genrich's lawyers, the city of Green Bay has actually retained outside counsel for this case, had come to an agreement about postponing in-person testimony after documentation was reviewed, after the city turned over about 20,000 or more than 20,000 pages of election-related documents. And so they want Gableman to essentially publicly apologize for saying that Genrich hasn't cooperated by providing that in-person testimony yet. They want him to take out full-page ads in newspapers across the state saying that he made false statements, do things like undergo 3 hours of ethics training. So a pretty strong, pushback from Genrich's lawyers here saying, hey, Gableman has really misrepresented how this relationship has played out over the past few months.
And has the former Supreme Court Justice Gableman or his team, have they responded to this?
They haven't. I reached out for comment yesterday, and we haven't heard back from them on that. But it has certainly been a drumbeat from Gableman for the past several weeks at least, that there hasn't been the level of cooperation that he's wanted from specific officials across the state for his investigation. And that has prolonged the investigation. The investigation has gone past a couple different sort of understood deadlines. We first thought it was going to be done in the fall of last year. And he said that's partially because folks haven't, given him what he's asked for up until this point.
Let's talk about that, the wider sort of timeline of this investigation. As you said, it went past the initial goal deadline. We're hearing from Assembly Speaker Voss, who in effect convened this investigation. What's the latest talk about when this thing could wrap up?
So this is really evolving and complicated. We actually got a little bit of new information today. WisPolitics reported that Speaker Voss is saying that he wants the investigation to be wrapped up by the end of this month, by February, or the end of February. He said wrapped up by February. So I suppose that could be the end of February as well. And that's an interesting kind of development because, as I mentioned, the first understood deadline was the fall. Then Voss said the end of 2021. And now he's saying that this agreement, which he says isn't on paper, it's just a spoken agreement between himself and former Justice Gableman, is for, essentially, less than 2 months from now. And some of the new developments in terms of legal filings in this investigation include subpoenas that went out not long ago over the holidays between Christmas and New Year's that actually have dates for in-person testimony in mid-February. So if Gableman were to meet this new deadline that the speaker has mentioned, it would be a very, very quick turnaround from when this scheduled subpoenaed testimony would take place in mid-February to him wrapping up the investigation and issuing his recommendations.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast, looking at the ongoing Gableman investigation, looking back at the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about all the angles here going on. I will go to a caller now. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi. I'm a little jaded, so hopefully this doesn't offend anybody, but I think all politicians are like criminals. And, if you got nothing to hide, why aren't you a little more forthcoming? I love my country. I just fear my government. That's all,
Nick, thanks for the call. And, Laurel, that's been an argument from Gableman and I think Assembly Speaker Voss at some point. Why not cooperate if everything is hunky-dory? Is that something we've heard from the leaders of this investigation?
Absolutely, 100%. They have said just that. If there's nothing to hide, why don't you come forward and provide testimony? And the pushback from folks has been that there are multiple parts of it. So I would say one of the primary arguments from these mayors, and Genrich has been a focus, as has Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway, saying that they want testimony to be conducted in a certain way and agreed upon, particularly done in public. They don't want their testimony to be provided behind closed doors. They think it's something that the public should be able to witness, sort of what the questions are, what their answers are, because it's a taxpayer-funded investigation. They think that that's appropriate. Gableman wants these in-person interviews to be done behind closed doors because he says kind of having it out in public would give folks a heads up about what the questions are, people kind of later in line, right? He says that would compromise the integrity of the investigation. So that's one big element of pushback, kind of the public versus private element of these interviews. But there are several other things that are actually pending in a lawsuit about the enforceability of the subpoenas. And that lawsuit was brought by State Attorney General Josh Call, who's representing the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which has been subpoenaed in the case. And he says that the subpoenas aren't enforceable for a number of other reasons, including the investigation kind of going beyond its appropriate scope, becoming sort of a criminal enterprise, a law enforcement enterprise, not a legislative one. The fact that the scope of the subpoenas is so broad that they're inappropriate. It also makes some due process arguments. And really, you know, you mentioned that there have been so many developments in this story, right? We're actually waiting on a decision in that case that's expected to come either tomorrow or Monday. So we're going to get a lot of additional kind of information about how this is going to move forward within the next few days.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Speaking of new developments this week, news about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a separate court case. This was yesterday, I think. This was a suit now challenging Voss for not, as I understand it, Laurel, revealing some documents related to the investigation. What's the background on that?
So the background on that is there's a liberal group called American Oversight that has been for several months trying to get Speaker Voss to release documents about the election investigation. They want him to release contracts, communications between himself and Gableman, basically just information about kind of the structure of the investigation, the expectations, staffing, things like that. They argue that that's appropriate under public record because this is a taxpayer-funded effort. And Voss has been very resistant to that and has sort of echoed the sentiments of Gableman that I mentioned earlier about compromising the integrity of the investigation by making certain things public, giving folks a heads up ahead of time so they can be in sort of a defensive posture before they are asked to provide information. And so about election administration.
And so the new development here is a judge says, yeah, you're going to need to tell us something, right?
Right. So basically the new order is a judge saying, Speaker Voss, you need to sit for a deposition and explain why you haven't released some documents or what your decision-making process has been or your process for going about fulfilling records requests. Essentially, she said she's trying to make sure that there aren't documents in existence that he hasn't been putting forward because the group that's asked for them said that the record fulfillments that they've gotten haven't been sufficient.
We're talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. She's with us today with the latest, and there's a lot of latest, on the Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see those communications about the Republican-backed investigation be made public? What do you think of the idea from some Republicans to get rid of the Wisconsin Elections Commission? What questions do you have about all the twists and turns in this investigation? Do you think it should still be going on, or do you think there's been enough between the courts and other investigations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about Republican efforts to investigate the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin. WPR's Laurel White stays with us, and you can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now with Sarah in Eau Claire. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I guess I was...
Are you still there, Sarah? Oh, I guess she is not. Let's see. Our producer says Sarah was hoping that Whatever comes out of this has some teeth, that this isn't just a, I guess, a formal investigation without consequences. And Laurel, what is the stated goal of this investigation? Is it the idea that there will be flaws found in the 2020 election, or like the Legislative Audit Bureau's audit, ways to improve Wisconsin's election in the future? What is the final product supposed to be as far as we know?
I think the understanding right now, based on comments from leaders, is that there are going to be recommendations from former Justice Gableman for changes to Wisconsin election laws based on his review. So, like you said, kind of similar to the audit that we received from the Legislative Audit Bureau late last year, which made dozens of recommendations for changes to Elections Commission policies and state laws. It would be a kind of, here's a roadmap moving forward, at least in, you know, Gableman's opinion, of ways to make elections more secure, to ensure more public faith and kind of the process.
Let's go now to Russ in Belleville. Russ, hello.
Hey, Al. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Russ?
Well, I'm really tired of the Republicans wasting our money on this witch hunt. I mean, the only reason my boss started this is because Trump pitched a fit with him, and like most of the other Republicans, they're afraid of Trump. So, you know, look at Trump lost by 20,000 votes. Hillary Clinton lost by the same number of votes. And if she had pitched a fit like this, the Republicans have been all over calling her a sore loser. So it's just a problem in search of us, or not it's a solution in search of a problem. And they're just making it so that people don't trust the election anymore, because they're the ones who are making all these false claims that have been shot down in every court and every review.
Russ, thanks for the call. Is there a sense, Laurel, among some, that Republicans might be looking over their shoulders at former President Trump and doing this kind of investigation with him in mind?
Well, that is definitely something that's been part of the conversation. And we know that Speaker Voss has acknowledged that he has been in touch with former President Trump throughout this investigation. He said, you know, it's not frequent, but that he has spoken with the former president several times to just kind of keep him apprised of what's going on. So there's certainly no indication that the former president isn't weighing on the mind of Speaker Voss as this process unfolds, and that he's had kind of an influence on it.
Thanks for that call, Russ. We'll go to Terry next in Green Bay. Terry, hello.
Yeah. Hey, I just wanted to mention that, you know, I think our mayor is just terrible. I mean, what he did in the 2020 election, as far as getting involvement from taking the money from Mark Zuckerberg and actually implementing and taking away the register of deeds to, violating her position and putting someone in there involved is just terrible. I mean, the guys should be run out of town. And tell you what, he's just going to be a one-time mayor. This guy is, and he should be facing Gableman. If you're not scared, just go ahead and do it.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. Terry pointing toward what former Justice Gableman is talking about, the a nonprofit funded in large part by Mark Zuckerberg, providing assistance to communities, including Green Bay, leading up to that election.
Right. That's a big part of Gableman's investigation, are these grants from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which was founded and funded by Mark Zuckerberg and his wife. And Republicans have pushed back and said that those grants, particularly in the five largest cities in Wisconsin, which got the lion's share of the money, money did go to a number of other communities in Wisconsin from the organization to help with election administration. But the biggest cities got the biggest chunks of money. They say that that enabled undue influence by this outside group. And there's been a lot of pushback to that from the other side, saying that communities needed this support and that reviews have found that the outside, individuals that were involved didn't do anything to skew election results or compromise the process.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Nate joins us next in Northeast Wisconsin. Nate, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to ask about, Nate?
I have a question about the type of investigation that former Justice Gableman is engaged in. I'm wondering if this sort of investigation has any precedents in Wisconsin history, and if so, have those earlier investigations have any limitations set on them in terms of scope or length.
Oh, interesting, Nate. Have we seen things like this before, Laurel?
That's a really interesting question, and one that I can't answer with 100% certainty. I know that I am not aware of anything like this, at least in the recent history of Wisconsin. I think, you know, having a legislative body approve an investigation like this is something that is written into state law as possible. So, and there are structures for it. So it's not something that has just been brought up or, created for this process. But I'm not aware of anything recent that we can point to and say, hey, these were the parameters that were followed for another investigation. And those are, you know, potentially need to be applied here.
Nate, thanks for calling. Jeff joins us next in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for this opportunity. I have a lot of opinions on various levels of this topic, not only nationally, but certainly in Wisconsin. I'm a resident of Superior and in Douglas County. I had a conversation with our county clerk regarding counting the ballots in the last election, and one of her concerns was, and she's actually a Democrat, was concerned that the military votes come by PDF file. So those military votes could have been switched. Those things need to be investigated. I'm glad that Speaker Voss is authorizing this investigation. There's other rumors of rest home residents not voting or voting twice, things like that. Those things need to be investigated. And I personally believe, right or wrong, that Wisconsin's electors chosen for the Electoral College were not legitimate because of the absentee ballots in Wisconsin.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We had the Legislative Audit Bureau audit, Laurel, and they didn't find fraud or mistaken ballots at anything like the five-digit number range, right?
Right. So we have had, as you mentioned, that Legislative Audit Bureau audit, which was a statewide audit. We've had several audits conducted by the State Elections Commission that are routine after every election. We had a presidential recount in both Dane and Milwaukee counties that were conducted and found very few vote changes. And we also had, as folks I'm sure recall, several lawsuits after the 2020 election. And none of those were successful in court in proving any sort of widespread fraud or wrongdoing. And that's a big pushback on this investigation, is that there have already been so many inquiries to see if there had been things that would have changed the outcome of the election. And they just haven't been uncovered to this point.
Thanks for the call. Laurel, I just want to take our last minute and a half or so for another big angle. Some calls to get rid of the Wisconsin Elections Commission coming from some, but not all, Republicans. Can you give us the Cliff's Notes version of that?
So that kind of comes from the Legislative Audit Bureau audit of election administration in 2020. A lot of Republicans were concerned about Elections Commission policy changes that were recommended in that audit. They said that the number of recommended changes reflected poorly on how the Elections Commission has handled Wisconsin elections. And so they have said its administrator needs to step down. There need to be conversations about replacing it potentially. But that's something that we learned this week doesn't have the support from a very important person in Wisconsin politics, which is the Senate Majority Leader, Devin Lemahieu. If something like that was going to move forward from the legislature and even, you know, begin the path to the governor's desk, it would need support from someone like him. So it doesn't look like that kind of change is on the table, at least for now.
Laurel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. She was with us today to catch us up on a lot of the latest on investigations into the 2020 election still going on here in Wisconsin. You can find her reporting at WPR.org while you're there. You can, of course, check out the WPR Politics Podcast. Great way to stay on top of the latest going on here in the state. And follow us on Facebook. The Ideas Network Facebook page will keep you up to date as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, many Americans worked at home at some point in the last couple of years, for better or worse. And that gives us a chance to rethink the workplace, to make us happier and more productive. It's according to the authors of the new book, Out of Office. You can hear the story and maybe weigh in with your own experience. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Are you still looking for a 2022 New Year's resolution? How about some help for the world of artificial intelligence research? Janelle Shane of the website AI Weirdness has been a guest on the show. She fed some prompts to machine learning algorithms to get some unique ideas to kick off the new year. Some were standard and or boring, but here are a few of the more interesting ones she shared following her prompt for unique resolutions. Here we go. Record every adjective I hear on the radio. Act like a cabbage for a month. At 4 o'clock every day, I will climb a tree. Speak only to apples for 24 hours. Dress in a way that only a ghost could love. Find Old Man Winter, hug him, and let him know everything will be okay. Here's a resolution. Under every rock I come across for a month, I'll write all power to the rocks. Or put on a red shirt and scream, I'm not wearing pants, every time I leave the house. Give them a try. Let us know how they turn out. This is Central Time.